You're listening to the Looseheads podcast. Join the movement.
Let's get people talking about mental health.
And together we will tackle the stigma. This is the Looseheads podcast.
So hello and welcome along to yet another Looseheads podcast in association with Talking Rugby Union with me, Chris Seal. And as always, we thank you, the listeners, for choosing our podcast, whether that is via Spotify or your chosen podcast app. And whether you are exercising or out for a run or just putting your feet up, hopefully we can keep you company for the next hour or so as we chat to yet another very special guest on the podcast. But before we introduce our guest, it would be very unfair for me not to give the floor to Dave Nicol to kick off this podcast, because we are recording a few days after Scotland had beaten England at Twickenham for the first time since 1983. So Dave, for 45 seconds or so, the floor is yours. What a performance from Scotland at the weekend.
Only 45 seconds?
I've had enough of the coverage this week.
Oh, mate, there's not much more to say about it, is there? Fantastic day. Just sort of a shame we let them get the losing bonus point at the end, but quite nice to get to watch it with my four-month-old. Got him kitted out in his Scotland gear. He actually fell asleep at half-time. I'm not sure if it was the excitement or England's tactics sending him to sleep, but good day all round and a few beers had.
Absolutely. I think I've said this to Rob also on another podcast this week, but he was supporting Scotland as well.
I was. Also, with it being Six Nations, can we just talk very quickly about which national anthem is the best? It's such a tough call. Being a Welsh supporter, it's got to be Wales number one. But what's number two, France or Scotland?
Or Ireland.
Or Ireland.
It could go to either, couldn't it? I'm always going to put my colours against the mast and say Scotland, but I don't think you can go too far wrong with La Marseillaise.
I'd go France or Scotland if I had to pick. On the fence, as always. But obviously, a lot more Six Nations to come, a lot more Premiership and Allianz Premier 15s over in the UK to look forward to over the next few weeks. But it's all about the here and now for the Looseheads podcast. And I'm very pleased to say we are joined all the way from Canada by Jamie Cudmore. So, Jamie, thanks so much for beginning your day, actually, by jumping on the Looseheads podcast and chatting to us. So, first of all, how are things over in Canada and how have you been during this strange time for us all?
Thanks, Chris. Thanks, boys. Thanks for having me on. Happy to be on and talk rugby. And you know, since the pandemic started, really, I think it's been crazy. You know, in trying to plan and try to organize. You know, everything's done in pencil these days because you know plans kind of blow up at the last minute because of you know somebody's gotten sick or there's more cases or whatever it may be. To be fair, we're in a pretty good place. You know, I'm based on Vancouver Island on the West Coast. You know, being on an island, it's a bit easier to keep the numbers down and, you know, we've got wide open spaces so we can get outside and, you know, enjoy ourselves as best we can here in the winter. You know, it's definitely been challenging for us and for everyone else.
Yeah, I should have asked you, Jamie, what you thought the best Six Nations national anthem is. I presume France would be up there for you.
Of course, you know, I'm French Canadian, so. Yeah, I definitely have a soft spot for France. My father's English, so you know, I was very lucky to be born in Canada. I don't get in these debates on you know, England, Scotland, France, Wales, but I do have a soft spot for the Welsh anthem, as I spent a couple of years there playing, and still have some great friends in the setup in Wales and playing and friends that I played with there. So, you know, I've got a soft spot for everyone. And then the Scots, you know, I've played with a lot of great Scottish players, you know, Jason White, Nathan Hines, Rory Lawson. So, you know, I was very, very happy for those boys this weekend to get a good win. And sorry for the name dropping, but, you know, just.
It's normally Rob's bag.
But you mentioned obviously all the rugby that's going on there, Jamie, and it's great that we do have Six Nations and everything to look forward to. We mentioned before we pressed record that you are obviously your coaching still going on over in Canada despite the winter conditions and despite everything that's going on in the world at the moment. And I guess sport has been a bit of a solace for us, hasn't it, over this very difficult time. We've been able to watch live sport, be involved in sport as well. And I think we may have missed it during the first lockdown we had in the UK. And when it came back, we realised the importance of it to everybody, and I guess everyone across the world has probably felt like that who have some sort of connection to sport.
Well, definitely, you know, like as we spoke about earlier, we're very fortunate for the majority of us here and myself being in an environment where we can still do what we love to do. or hear even talk about it. You know, if there was no sport being on, we wouldn't be talking about anything, would we? So, you know, we're pretty lucky to be where we're at. You know, for us locally, my academy program is still up and going. We've got games lined up for the next couple months. And then, hopefully the MLR goes off, next month. So, you know, that's exciting for us here in North America and to see, how things are going in Europe. You know, at least the Premiership's going, at least the top 14 is going. We've got some international stuff going on now. So, you know, that's exactly it. In the sanitary context, which is very, very difficult for a lot of people, at least there's a bit of solace in the week. We're seeing some games and, you know, getting a bit of a release and getting a bit of happiness because things are tough.
Yeah, and we know how much sport is used for such a powerful tool, Jamie, and we're going to come on to sort of your playing career and a bit about your coaching in a little bit later on in the podcast. But in terms of rugby for you, I know you've talked about before how much of an important part it played in terms of maybe turning your childhood around, if you like, but rugby was kind of a bit of a safety net for you and sort of made you, maybe changed you into the person you are today. That's a fair assessment.
Yeah, I wouldn't say I had a difficult childhood. I had a great childhood growing up in a small town in West Coast Canada. You know, got a great family, good friends. But I was kind of a big rambunctious boy that had a lot of energy that, you know, a lot of times that energy went in the wrong direction. You know, friends and myself, you know, we made bad decisions when we were teenagers, which most people do. So it was good that I got those kind of heebie-jeebies out of my pants when I was that age. And it didn't continue on into, you know, 18, 19, 20 and onwards. And rugby was kind of that avenue at that time to expend all that energy that I had. And it was great. You know, I was at the time I was working in the bush and my boss was the president of the local club. And he said, listen, if you don't want to work Saturday, why don't you come down and play rugby? And I was like, oh yeah, rugby. Okay. Like my dad had played rugby in England and before he immigrated to Canada. And when he had always dreamed of us playing rugby, but you know, small town on the West Coast up in the mountains, there's not much in the way of sport unless you want to, you know, play hockey. And I did mostly, like, I skied a lot when I was a kid, you know, high school skiing and like the high school ski club, which is maybe a little foreign for people in England, but you know, here we're 20 minutes away from Whistler. So, you know, that was my playground as a kid. So very fortunate to grow up in a place like that. And, you know, my wife said, there's no way you're playing hockey because it's too violent. So I went to rugby. Anyway, and this was like I was about 15, 16 at the time I started playing. And, you know, I really enjoyed myself. You know, I was with a group of guys similar to me, you know, like guys from many different walks of life. And, you know, we get down to the field on a Saturday and change on the back of our pickup trucks and throw your boots on the field and off you went. First few scrums, you know, boys be puking up from the night before because they maybe had a few beers on a Friday night. And every time I hit somebody or ran really, really well or whatever, like did something positive, you know, you get a slap on the back. And, so the boss said, listen, you know, like you're doing all these things on the field. This is great. Like if you do it here, you get applauded for it, whereas you do it on the street or in the bar or whatever, then you're going to get in trouble. So it was really great, you know, just expending that energy in the proper way. And then I just kept going with it. So I went from Squamish, went to Vancouver, started playing at the Capilanos, my club, and then I got a chance to go to New Zealand, and then it just kind of snowballed after that, where I was invited to our development academy, the Pacific Pride, which I now head coach. Funnily enough, he kind of full circle. And then from that, I had opportunities with Canada. And then I had an opportunity to go play in Wales. And then World Cup. And then next thing I know, I'm in France. And geez, almost 20 years later, I'm back in Canada. And I kind of blink and think, geez, what just happened? But no, it was great that I had that that avenue to kind of, you know, send those negative waves and kick on to have a hell of a lot of fun in rugby, and I'm still doing it.
Yeah, just listening to you there, Jamie, it's clear how much of an influence rugby's had on your life, and it still is obviously a major part of your life as well. And just to go back to something that I said before about using rugby in a positive way and making a difference, because I know you and your wife, Jennifer, set up the Rugby Safety Network. Was it in 2016? Correct me if I'm wrong. But it was as a foundation to improve the education around concussion as well. And looking back, obviously, people know kind of your story, Jamie, around concussion. But was that something that you thought, right, I do want to give something back to rugby because of what it's given me?
No, definitely. We saw there was a major problem, definitely in France, around concussion education, and in rugby in general. And that in those times, kind of 2000 onwards, we were seeing a lot of research, a lot of data through hockey, through NFL, and nothing really being done in rugby. I've got like friends of mine that are playing pro hockey over here, or football or whatever, and they're saying like, oh, okay, we're changing this, we're changing that, we're looking at how much we do contacted training and this, that, and the other. And I'm thinking in rugby, I'm like, geez, we go like 3-4 days a week, and we're hammering each other on the Saturday, and then you go for a couple of beers maybe once a month, and then you just keep going, it didn't seem to me like we were addressing a problem which was quite apparent at the professional level. And don't get me started on the amateur level, because those guys are playing on a Sunday and then they're going to work the next day, and who knows what problems they might have had from the game. So the biggest thing, the biggest space where we thought we could make a difference was through education, and at the schoolboy level, so kids, so rugby schools, mini rugby, just getting in there and talking to kids so that they understand what a concussion is. They understand how to protect themselves before, during, and after. Educating parents, educating educators, coaches, managers, team members, because a lot of people just don't know. There's still that old adage of, oh, he's a big, strong kid. You put the magic sponge on the back of the neck and give him a bit of a shake and off you go type of thing. Well, as we all know, that can kill people. So you need to be very, very, very careful when you have an injury, especially an injury such as a concussion where it's invisible. You break a guy's leg. Well, if you break your leg, you're not going to keep trying to run around the field. Where why do we do the same thing with concussion or perceived concussion? So, we saw that there was a space there, and we tried to fill it. And we did quite a few years of some really good work with different tournaments around France, down in the Monaco, had some really, really good traction. And unfortunately, last year, moving back to Canada, we haven't been able to continue on this work. I still talk about it as much as I can with other people, with my group. We're very, very stringent on any of those things. We monitor our impacts during the week, because I think the modern game, you've got all the tools at your disposal to, as best as possible, protect your players, because you're never going to protect people 100%. Contact sport, when it does happen, we address it. And when my guys are injured, they're gone. They're with the medical team. They're basically not my guys anymore. They're medical team's guys. Once they're fit and they're deemed fit and they've gone through all the return to play stuff, and whether it's 3 days, whether it's 5 weeks, whether it's 6 months, or whether they don't play again, well, that's unfortunate, but, we're not going to put guys at risk. And it's too bad that, things have clouded because of money, because of pressure to win, and X number of things, where we're putting guys at risk. And the reason we tried to go to the education side is because we see what happens at the top of the pyramid, the international games, the professional games, and who watches that? Well, we all watch it, but so do the kids. So the kids always replicate what they see the pros do. I see the kids out here, my kids out here on the street, they're playing hockey just like the pros do on the weekend. They're trying to do all the different moves and this, that, and the other. Well, if they see a guy get laid out on the ice or on the field and he comes back in 10 minutes later to play, well, what are we showing our kids? it's ridiculous. HIAs and 6-day turnarounds and all that. It's not for the players. It's not for us. It's for the people making money and trying to create a spectacle. So, I think we really need to look at, how we deal with this problem, because if we don't deal with it properly now, we're going to blow up rugby for forever. The NFL have gotten their head around it. They've been proactive on the problem. And, whether you agree with it or not, it doesn't matter. They're trying to be proactive at a problem that they see for the longevity of their game. If world rugby don't do the same thing, I really think we're going to suffer in the long term.
Yeah, it's interesting what you say there, Jamie. We saw at the weekend, and this is not you know, pointed a finger at Johnny Sexton, but Johnny had to come off because he got a concussion. And you could see he was disappointed. It's a big game. It's a Six Nations game. It's Wales versus Ireland. The pressure's on to get the result. And he was not happy what to come off. I mean, I spoke to Rob yesterday. There was a game in the Premiership. Another player did that. There was a game recently in the Champions Cup. And that just needs to change as well, doesn't it, Jamie? That the decision has to be taken out of the player's hand. And it does give less pressure on physios and doctors if they know that education as well.
Oh, of course. You know, I went through the same thing in 2015 where, you know, two different games in a 2-week period where I went through three different head knocks and was allowed to go back out on the field every single time. You know, it has to be taken out of the player's hands, because I think at pretty much every level as a rugby player, you always want to be on the field. You don't want to let your teammates down. You want to be out there to help, to win, and to be a part of the fight, you know? And you're exactly right. It needs to be taken out of their hands, because they're not in a headspace where they can make a proper decision. You know, I was going to say educated, but they might not be educated. So, you know, it needs to be taken out of their hands. Exactly.
What actually happens in the deep end there in the professional game where the doctor is talking to the player? What's the conversation? Obviously, you know, it happened at the weekend. It happens all the time, but you know, you must be, when you're tuning into games now, you must have one eye on that all the time. What are those conversations like?
Well, I can't speak for the conversations of this weekend, obviously, but, you know, I can only speak on my own. And, you know, if I go back to 2015, where semifinal European Cup against Saracens in Saint-Étienne, where I came flying into a ruck at the same time as Billy Vunipola, so it was basically like two Rams button heads in up in the mountains here. And we both kind of are lying there, Jesus, whoa, what's going on? Anyway, the physio got to me. I was split open for blood, so he took me off for blood. Doctor saw that I had, you know, I was out of it, put me through an HIA. I failed the HIA. He stitched me up. He's like, all right, you're done. So this, we had two doctors that day. So I went back in the change room. I was upset, you know, doc, no worries. Just stitch me up. I can get back out there. It's fine. Anyway, I go sit down. I go to take my boots off. I'm dejected. I'm super upset. Like, it's ridiculous. I want to be part of this game. So he said, no, it's done. So anyway, he's cleaning up his gear in the other room. And a couple minutes later, the other doctor comes in. He goes, Jamie, Seb's no good. You got to come back on. And I'm thinking, awesome, great, tie up my boot, let's go. Finish the game, don't really remember much from the end of that game. I do remember after the game being really, really like in cotton wool, like not happy that we won. Like, geez, we're in a semifinal, we won, we're in the final in 2 weeks. Like, everybody should be elated. And I just can't get up. I went up, had some food, got in the bus, had a beer, like, didn't want to drink the beer, left the beer, just kind of sat there, like not able to sleep, but really tired, or just really like classic symptoms of a big knock. Went through a graduated return to play the following week. So normally return to play 6 days, because we had our game. The final was in 2 weeks time. I started on the Tuesday and I went to the following Tuesday. I got the green light, you know, through the neurologist, through the doctor, through everyone, through myself, because I wanted to play as well. You know, everybody's pushing me to say, yeah, you're good. Anyway, first tackle I made in the final 2 weeks later, I finished on my ass. You know, it was two guys that came through the same hole, and I tackled correctly in and under the elbows, shoulder contact, but just that impact was enough to spark me out again. So I'm on my ass looking up at the lights and twicking. I'm thinking, geez, this is weird. Like, this normally doesn't happen to me. Anyway, the ref's there and the physio gets there and they take me off for HIA. I pass that HIA. I go back on the field, finish, keep playing. Second half, 67th minute, I have a head knock with one of their players, back row player, and I get cut. So I have to go off for blood. And when I go off to get the blood, get stitches, I start feeling really nauseous. Anyway, I had to puke a few times into the garbage can in the change room. I got our bag man, and I think it was our 24th guy was Benson Stanley. He's there with me, and the docs, doc finished stitching me up, and I'm like, yeah, doc, I gotta get back out there. You know, you puke, you get that kind of adrenaline rush. You feel a lot better.
So I felt great, and I just wanted to get out there and finish the game. Betson's kind of going, "Doc, are you sure?" And the bagman's like saying the same thing. And I don't really, you know, I'm not thinking about that. I just want to go out there. Anyway, went out, finished the game. And from then on, like, I had about 10 days where I didn't sleep, no real support. Like, it was bad. Like, I was at home like a monster. My wife, kids couldn't come in the room. I just had to sit there in the bed and didn't sleep for like 10 days. Like, I don't know if you guys haven't slept for like 2 or 3 days, but it makes you go crazy. And I was crazy. Like, my wife was thinking, like, I got to call an ambulance, get him in the hospital or something, because it was pretty bad. Anyway, that's when, from that incident, that's when we really started researching as to like why this happened, how come I was able to play through all this stuff, even though, sure, I wanted to. But like you said earlier, it shouldn't have been my decision. So that's basically where RSN was born. And we've been pushing on ever since.
Do you think education will ever be enough to, one, stop players kind of having that mentality of, I've got to get back out on the pitch no matter what, and two, kind of doctors and physios getting that pressure from coaches to get players back out on the pitch? Or does it need sort of a completely neutral individual involved with those decisions?
I think probably at the professional level right now, you need somebody independent. As we know, education takes a long time to disseminate throughout everybody. But, you know, you start with kids now. In 20 years, you're going to have a lot more people that are educated around the dangers of it. And you're going to have teammates that are see your buddy at the face down in a ruck going, "Oh shit, hey buddy, have a look there, physio, come have a look at him." You know, for your teammates looking out for each other, because at the end of the day, that's what everybody does, right? That's part of the rugby ethos. You look out for the opponent, you look out for your player. Sure, you're trying to win, you're trying to dominate them, but you know, when somebody's hurt, you don't add insult to injury. You try to help the guy out. At least that's my opinion around it. But, you know, people, I see stuff on social media all the time. People are like, "Oh, Cudmore, yeah, but you knock people out left, right, and center." And I say, "Well, yeah, because I'm trying to do the best for my team." But once the guy's knocked out, like, I'm not hitting him again. You know what I mean? Like, the guy's out. I mean, you know, I've done well for my team. That's rugby. You know, you're trying to dominate, trying to move forward. Because at the end of the day, that's why we play rugby. We want to move forward. But, you know, when the education piece is around those injuries, I think the more people that are educated around it, you can make a better decision, you know. So hopefully we can just keep moving forward. And like, independent investigators, doctors is one thing. And why we have this 6-day turnaround is, well, I know why, but it's absolutely ridiculous.
How do you think it plays out when in the UK, obviously I play at a local rugby club. There's 350 kids on a Sunday. It's brilliant. You know, it's the very ethos of rugby. But the parents that bring those kids down when they're 6 and 7 and 8, they've probably still got an influence on them when they're 15, 16.
Yep.
If rugby generally, well, just doesn't address this issue, you're going to get the mums and dads who take their kids off to play junior rugby and mini rugby, just saying, this is too, in a high profile way, this is too dangerous for my child to play. So rugby's got to come up with an answer, I guess.
Well, you're exactly right. You know, I talked about the NFL being proactive before. Rugby can be proactive here now. You know, like, I know a lot of the concussion stuff is out on their website. You know, a lot more can be done. You know, we get, community outreach officers out teaching this stuff, allaying fears of parents, you know, teaching them about the ins and outs of, you know, proper tackle technique, you know, neck strengthening exercises that you can do it under sixes. You know, the biggest thing for them is creating more space for when they're learning the game, because that's going to work on their soft skills. That's going to work on their catch pass skills. And the fact that there's more space is going to take away a lot of those impacts. And then as kids get older, continuing to keep space, maybe less players on the field when they're in those building block phases. And just showing that the rugby instances are trying to be proactive around this problem, because if we don't, exactly as you said, the grassroots will die, and if the roots die, well, the tree goes with it. So, you know, we've got to be proactive.
And for you, Jamie, have you maybe seen since you set up the Rugby Safety Network, small improvements, steps forward in the game? Obviously, HIs is one thing that people do look at and go, that's definitely an improvement to avoid the number of head injuries. But have you seen personally and honestly, have you said, well, actually, yes, we are making steps forward and this is really positive, but there is still a lot more that can be done?
Yeah, there's definitely a lot more to be done, but, you know, there are positive signs as well. You know, I've heard it with my guys in the academy, you know, so-and-so, oh, he doesn't look too bad. He's a little shaky. You know, we talk about it. You know, we're not trying to hide things because, you know, you're not soft because you get a concussion. It's just, that's what happens. Your brain stops too quick. So, you know, it is working. And it comes from, you know, understanding the problem and making sure that, you look out for your friends, you look out for yourself. And like we said about the kids at that age, if they're taught properly, you know, throughout their lives, you know, when you become a professional coach or you become a professional doctor or somebody involved in the upper echelons of the game, if you would have been educated since you were a kid around this problem, well, it'd be a no-brainer. You're like, oh, so-and-so, yeah, I saw that suspected concussion, you know, take him off. He won't want to come off, of course, but, you know, at least he'd be ready to go in a couple of weeks or, you know, whenever the doctors deem him fit to get back on the field.
Yeah. And just in terms of sort of the coaching side of things that you talked about there, Jamie, and you said, oh, my players are starting to think like that. But is that something that I know obviously you talked about their results are important, but have you kind of been saying at the top of your agenda that concussion, the approach towards concussion has to be right up there with what you do as a coach at the moment?
Oh, definitely. You know, that's part of our entry. You know, when guys are injured, if you're injured, you cannot train, you cannot play. It's a concussion is an injury, like a knee, ligament injury, shoulder, you know, obviously it needs to be treated much more seriously, but it is still an injury. So when those guys are in the red zone or the yellow zone on our medical return sheets, we've got green, yellow, red. If they're in green, they're good to go. They're with me. If they're in yellow or in red, they're with the medical staff or they're in return to play. So, you know, these guys, when they're injured, and they understand this, not to hide injuries because it's just going to make things worse. If you have an injury, get it dealt with, get yourself fully fit, and then we'll get you back into the field. Because as we are an academy team, it's not rush, 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 like in a professional team where you need to be fit on Tuesday so I can pick you on Tuesday and then get you ready for Saturday. That turnaround is a hell of a lot faster and a lot more pressure. But, you know, with my guys, we're very clear. When you're injured, you're out, and, that's fine. You'll have time to get ready, to get strong, and then get, back on the field so that you can perform. But, you know, before that, I'm not going to look at it.
Yeah. And I mean, just a final point on this, JB, it seems obviously you're being incredibly proactive about this with in terms of your job. And as we talked about there, hopefully rugby is making the steps forward. But this all comes back to the research that was maybe there 34 years ago, whether the data there could have helped change the game. And it's probably part of your ongoing case. And obviously the Steve Thompson and Alex Pop and stuff. So do you kind of think that the data was there maybe 30, 40 years ago, but now we're hopefully starting to realize that we can use education in a positive way?
Oh, definitely. The data has been out there since the 70s. Nobody can dispute that. You know, you look at all the head injury symposiums that they've had in New Zealand and Germany and the UK, you know, it's been there. But, you know, certain people haven't decided to look at it and actually, one, either accept it, or two, they've taken recommendations from concussion groups, which have, you know, different agendas, which is really too bad. Like the concussion in sport group, Jesus Christ, it's like telling kids that it's okay to smoke because, you know, it's a cool thing to do. Like it's the same thing with rugby. Like, oh, don't worry, it's a head injury. You know, it's not a big deal. Just throw a headgear on and you'll be fine next week. Like this stuff is absolutely ridiculous. They just want the spectacle to go on, you know, and they got big money behind them, and they're, you know, I don't want to sound like a conspiracy theorist, but I've seen the data and I've seen the minutes of some of the meetings, and it's pretty scary that, you know, these people are allowed to make rules for the greater rugby world, which don't make any sense whatsoever, except for the bottom line.
Yeah, it's obviously a very serious subject, and it's something that hopefully we will be able to take forward steps on. And the work you're doing, Jamie, is obviously fantastic in terms of bringing that into your coaching side of things as well. But just before we go into sort of your coaching, Jamie, Rob, I just want to bring you in on sort of making a change and making a difference by using rugby. We know Looseheads do that a lot, but I know you've had a chat with Alex Popham, who we've referenced a number of times in terms of the concussion element. I know him and his wife Mel have recently set up Head for Change, which is hopefully gonna make a difference in this area. So if you don't mind just shedding a little bit of light on that, and again, it's great work which Alex and Mel are hopefully going to be able to do.
Yeah, I spoke to Mel and Alex Popham probably about 4 or 5 weeks ago now. Just after Christmas. Lovely people. Alex is obviously going through a lot at the moment. What a great guy. Wow, what a great guy. Spoke about their current situation and what they're going through. And it's very, or it would be, very easy and understandable for them to sort of deal with that behind closed doors. But because they're getting in front of people, they're getting out there, they're setting up Head for Change, it shows the sort of generous people they are, wanting to help others and keep raising awareness. So it's same goes for you, Jamie. And we spoke to Alex about ways in which we at Looseheads can potentially work with Head for Change and support that. So yeah, amazing, and what a guy.
Yeah, and I think sort of what you've done, Jamie, is brilliant. You kind of, if you don't mind me saying, kind of spark this conversation. And I guess when Alex and Steve are looking for any inspiration, I think they can take it from you, Jamie. And this is the thing as well, just finally on this. You've never set out, Jamie, to ruin the sport. This isn't to take away, you know, the hard hits in rugby. This isn't a way to take away some of the fundamentals of what we love about the game. This is just to protect the next generation of players, isn't it? And Alex and Steve and yourself have always reiterated that.
No, that's exactly it. You know, if, you know, my legal proceedings are successful, and they have been so far, you know, this all goes to RSN so we can continue on our work. It's the same thing with Alex. You know, he's setting up things for the future for the players that are suffering now. But more importantly, as you said, we're setting it up for the future so the game stays sustainable. And as Mark talked about earlier, those kids on the weekend that are at mini rugby on a Sunday, those are the most important. You know, it's not the guys playing on the weekend in the Six Nations. Because those guys are at the top of the pyramid. We need the bottom of the pyramid to be the more supported and the more educated as possible, because those people will stay in rugby if they have a good experience. They might not get to the English team or the Scottish team or, you know, the Canadian team, but they'll be involved in rugby. They'll be rugby supporters. They'll be rugby administrators. They'll maybe be a teacher that'll introduce rugby to a school that doesn't have rugby. You know, it needs to be a positive experience from day one, and we'll all be rugby fans for the rest of our lives, which I had a positive experience. I think we all of us here had a positive experience. And if you have a positive experience in doing anything, you're probably going to keep doing it. So, you know, let's keep it up.
Hi guys, I'm Sam James. I'm a Looseheads ambassador, and you're listening to the Looseheads podcast. Make your mental health a priority.
Just to bring it to your coaching now, and it sounds like, as I mentioned in reference before, that you are creating an environment for these young players in Canada to really thrive at the moment. So how much you were enjoying that role, and why did you decide to step into coaching after playing the game?
Well, I actually stepped into coaching basically at the beginning of my career. I was coaching high school rugby in Canada before I left. I coached mini rugby in New Zealand when I was down there. It was awesome. Sunday morning, everybody running around barefoot, kids playing, stringing together passes better than a lot of professional teams I could see playing. And then came back to Canada, did some more high school rugby in Wales, did some high school rugby coaching as well. Then, you know, when I got into kind of the teeth of my professional career, I didn't have too much time for it until kind of the last, you know, 5-6 years I was involved with Clermont, where I was coaching with the S-Bot, the cadets and the S-Bots, so like under 16s and under 23s. Did really well there. We won 3 French championships. You know, I was really happy to be a part of that with Sam Sharoop, their head coach. Had some great players coming through that group. You know, you look at like Raka, Wesley Fofana, the Lannan brothers, the two twins who are playing for Clermont right now. You look at a lot of that Clermont group, they came through that Espoir team, that I was very fortunate to be a part of. And then moving on to Oyonnax, after that, where, we were very fortunate to have won the Pro de Deux, got one ascension to the top 14. And then for myself, I was 38 years old at that time. You know, I just didn't think that I could do one more year. So I moved directly into coaching, with the top 14 team there. Great experience, some great guys. Just unfortunate that I was with a director of rugby that was, basically a lying piece of shit. So, you know, pardon the language, but don't worry. I told him that face to face before I told you guys. So, you know, there's the one thing, I need a high level of integrity in when I work with anybody. And if you're dishonest or you're a shithead, well, you know, I'm going to tell you and we're not going to work anymore. So basically that's what happened 6 months out. I was very fortunate to work with a great backs coach in Mike Prendergast, who's up in Racing Metro right now, doing great things. Mike's a great coach, great guy, really good with the players, does really well with, you know, just making people understand the vision that he has around how to play the game and then implementing that. Took a lot of learnings off Mike. Unfortunately, in the situation we were at, was really bad. So anyway, I moved on and was very fortunate to get a general manager role in Provence in the Pro de Deux with a mandate of keeping the club up in the second division. So down there, it was a complete restructuring. We had a team that had come from the federal one, which had, you know, a new coach every year or every 2 years for about the last 10 years. And just nothing had been put in place. There was no foundations put in place. There was no gym. There was no nutrition plan. There was no GPS. It wasn't professional. So we basically completely restructured the club in terms of, you know, when the guys show up to work, the timings, you know, when the guys eat, you know, because it was all just kind of mixed up. There was no real plan behind anything. So we completely revamped that. We got them a proper gym. We got good S&T coaches in. We started doing the GPS. We integrated proper loading plans for the guys. And, you know, they started playing some really good rugby. We ended up finishing ninth, first year up in the Pro de Deux. So that was great. But unfortunately, as you know, the French, coaching system is quite toxic, to be fair. You know, there's a lot of boys throwing knives around. And, you know, if you don't come in with an actual team of coaching, like a coaching staff, it can be very, very difficult because you're spend half your time, trying to watch your back as opposed to actually trying to win games. So, you know, I saw things that were happening that I wasn't very happy with. And so I started looking away for a new job and, was very fortunate to chat with Kingsley Jones, here in Canada and, the rest of the, Gareth Reese and Alan Vanson, our president and talked about the future. And, the biggest piece of future of rugby in Canada was getting our academy back online. Because if you look at the academy back in its inception, 1995 to 2005, I went through that in 99. A lot of other guys went through, you know, Danny Baugh, Morgan Williams, John Tate, some really good players. Had like an over 1,000 caps come through that program. So we brought it back online last year. And it's been outstanding. We've gone from strength to strength. We've got over 17 guys that have come through the academy in the last 19 months. Down into MLR. This past November, we had a November camp for 3 weeks with the national team. I also do the forwards for Canada. And we had 15 of our academy guys involved in that camp. So, you know, as I talked about earlier, getting that grassroots thing going, getting guys pushed to the top, it's starting to work. And let's hope, over the next kind of, you know, 3 years World Cup cycle that we start seeing some new guys coming through and we can start pushing because, to be honest, the last 10, 15 years has been pretty bleak for us.
Yeah, it sounds like just all that experience you've been able to gain there, Jamie, up into where you are now has kind of maybe shaped you as the coach that you are today because you have those learnings and, you know, some of them good and obviously you say there, some of them bad, but that must have helped when you returned to Canada, that you had that experience in your to bring to that Canada performance pathway.
No, definitely, definitely. You know, it's every day is a learning experience, you know, whether it's good or bad.
you just keep pushing forward. So, I'm fortunate to be in an environment here where, you know, Kingsley gives us a lot of feedback. He's in trying to help, meeting up with Rob Howley last November and coaching with Rob was outstanding. You know, he's got a wealth of experience. Phil Mack as well, ex-Canadian international, who has just come back from the MLR coaching with Seattle, works with me day to day. So Phil's a great guy, good friend of mine. We played together for years, and it's great that we've got some really experienced coaches that are helping us grow. And then we got some good Canadian coaches that are trying to push rugby locally and nationally, and then hopefully this summer internationally. As I said, we'll pencil that in because who knows what's going to happen this summer.
You touched on it there briefly, Jamie, about it was kind of the pathway you came through when you were younger. So maybe from a self-indulgent point of view, Jamie, you must have so much pride being part of this pathway now that helped you kind of kickstart your career and move abroad.
Oh, definitely. You know, we had a major gap in Canada where our age grade, our high school programs, our age grade programs are very strong. But then when you get to under 20s, there's really nowhere to go. You've got a few university setups that are very strong. You know, you got Queens, UBC, UVic here on the West Coast. There's some great athletes. But problem is they're playing university rugby, which is good. But it won't prepare you for international rugby. It won't prepare you for professional rugby. It might give you a good base, but it'll still take a year or two to actually get to that level, maybe more. So the fact that we've got the academy online, we've got all these university setups now, you've got the MLR in Canada and south of the border. So now we've got some really good pathways to getting our guys properly loaded, properly skilled, and then into a professional environment or into a university environment. So whether they're making a bit of money in the MLR or they're in a university environment, they're getting good education. They're setting themselves up for the future and for success. So it's really great to have this back online.
We're kind of seeing this over here, Jamie, the growth of the MLR. And I don't know whether that's because of some of the stars that the league have been able to attract, you know, your Ben Foden, et cetera, like that. But it does seem like, fingers crossed, that we do get, you know, a full season. It's not cut short and things like that due to COVID. But it does seem like a very exciting prospect for USA and Canada, because I think that the Sevens World Cup was held in the US a couple of years ago. And there was excitement around that. But having a domestic league seems even more exciting for you guys.
Oh, it's huge. It's huge. And, it's a bit of the Wild West right now. There's some, you know, it's in its infancy. So, you know, there's positive signs. There's some worrying signs as well. But that's normal in the beginning of any business. You know, it's, you got ups and downs and, coronavirus definitely doesn't help, its growth right now. But, you know, you got some good people involved, definitely here in Canada. Bill Webb and Mark Winokur running the Toronto franchise have put up an amazing amount of work, amazing amount of investment. But, you know, they're doing it right. And, hopefully south of the border, those teams are doing the same thing. I think a majority of them are. We all hope it blows up, you know, like the MLS did. Only thing is, it's going to take quite a bit of time. You know, the MLS, what's like 20, 25 years now. So, fingers crossed, and we'll help keep feeding players south or over to Toronto. It's going to take a bit more time until it gets to be like a premiership or a top 14.
DTH is one of our ambassadors, and he's obviously gone over there. He's going to be playing for LA, but I saw a picture of him today. Actually, he's in Hawaii at the moment on a preseason tour, which isn't bad. It's a bit of a difference to Glasgow.
yeah, he's a little different from here because he lives on the island here as well, and he's got he's either got the beach or he's got, I don't know if you guys can see the snow out there. So he's definitely happier to be down there.
Yeah, and obviously DTH is one of the players, Jamie, who has experienced Europe in his career, and that the same applies to you. And I want to talk to you a little bit about sort of your journey in Europe. Obviously, you mentioned there sort of beginning in Wales, if that's right in saying. I mean, what was that like for you? Was it, I think you said 2002, 2003 before, sort of moving into Europe, moving to Wales and really beginning your journey there. What was that kind of experience like for you?
Oh, well, it was amazing, you know, full stop. I went from, as I said earlier, playing, getting changed off the back of a pickup truck in Squamish. Next year down to Vancouver, playing a bit better of a level. That summer, going down to New Zealand, playing a season of club rugby down there, pouring concrete, building houses, pouring concrete on a Saturday morning, playing rugby the same afternoon. I was loving it. And then came up to back to Canada and got this opportunity in Llanelli in Wales. So I went from like kind of just bouncing around the world playing rugby out of my pack sack and enjoying myself to walking into the change room with like Scott Cornell, Stephen Jones, like all these, the team of 0203 was basically the whole Welsh team. Sorry if I drop all those names wrong. Anyway, I just kind of sat down. I kind of looked around and thought, geez, how'd I end up here? And they're paying me for this? Like, excuse me? Like, I didn't even know it was possible to play professional rugby because, like, my dad used to have old Five Nations tapes where the boys would be running up and down the field and they'd have a few pints after the game and that'd be the end of it. I didn't know, like, it was, like, a viable, you know, like a job. So I was just happy to be there and happy to learn and happy to do my best. And, you know, I grew and got better and better and went to the World Cup that year. And then next thing you know, I had an opportunity to go to France. Didn't know where I was going. Didn't know what was happening. I showed up and they put me in an apartment hotel well outside of town. I was kind of lost and the taxi would pick me up every morning, take me into training. I didn't speak any French. So I was just kind of, you know, running by the seat of my pants, you know, like nowadays teams are well structured and they've got like normally most teams have like a guy that like helps everybody do their moves and stuff. Whereas there was like the manager, he came pick me up one day on a Friday before training. I think it was my second training. And he goes, oh, you want to get some lunch before we go to training? I said, oh yeah, sure. We show up at lunch. We're at Apero. So Apero is like when you get to the bar and you have like a drink before lunch. So the drink before lunch took like an hour. So there's like beer, champagne, this, that, and the other. I'm like, geez, are we going to sit down and have lunch? Like it's going to be training soon. Next thing you know, we get to the table, a few more bottles of wine. Then there's like a digestif after dinner, a couple coffees. And I'm thinking, Jesus, I don't know if I can be able to train here. I'm a bit gassed. So anyway, got to training, couldn't catch a ball to save my life. I'm just like the worst signing they've ever made ever. This guy, he's like comes into training, second day of training, half drunk with the manager. So, you know, I had some interesting situations, but, you know, from that, like enjoying my time in Grenoble and then getting the chance to go to Clermont, a couple years after. And, you know, Clermont had the infrastructure. They just didn't have kind of somebody to bring it all together. And the year after, Vern Cotter arrived. And, well, that was quite a wake-up call. Not so much for me and maybe some of the Anglo-Saxon guys, but definitely a lot of the French guys that were there kind of on holiday. He basically cleaned shop, got rid of a bunch of guys that were being, you know, just being lazy, and completely turned the club around. And I think the big reason that the Clermont are as strong as they are now is because of what he implemented back in 05.
It's weird because when we had DTH on the podcast, Jamie, he said quite a similar story to you, that he just sort of packed his bags and left for Europe. And he was just, you know, in his words, we're winging it a little bit. It was kind of, he was on this rugby journey and moving from different places. And it just seems like that's very similar to what you did at the start.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I was fortunate to have an opportunity after opportunity after opportunity. And you know, my mom gave me a little piece of advice when I was a kid. She said, when you're traveling, if somebody ever offers you to like go experience something, go check something out, just say yes. The majority of the time you'll have a good time, or you'll see something, or you'll enjoy it. So I did that, and geez, I've been around the world. So I can't, sometimes it's good to listen to mom, eh?
On to Clermont as well now, Jamie, and you know, we talked about obviously the concussion stuff before, and people might get the wrong idea. They just briefly skim over your story that, you know, you might not have enjoyed your time at Clermont because of the situation that developed from it. But that's absolutely not true, is it? You know, as you said there, you were playing in a great team. We had Benjamin Kayser on the podcast a couple of months ago as well, and he talked about sort of the passion of the fans and sort of that feeling of representing the club. Obviously, you went on to win honours with them as well. So it's quite clearly that you really enjoyed your time in the top 14 with one of the top clubs at the time.
Oh, definitely. Being at any professional club for 11 years, you've definitely got more good memories than bad. I really don't have any really bad memories, bar maybe the treatment in 2015. Mm. Like you said, the town, the region is completely behind the team. You know, like on a European Cup weekend, you see the whole center jog, like kind of the center square in town. All the fans are out with their yellow and blue gear on, and they get together with the opposing team, and then they all walk up the tramway up to the stadium with their horns and their bands and everything, and they walk by the hotel where we stay the morning of, where we do a bit of walk through, walk away from the stadium up to the hotel, have lunch, have a bit of a lie down, then we come into the game. And as you're kind of finishing your nap or whatever, getting ready to go, all the fans come by the front of the hotel. So it kind of creates this amazing level of excitement, you know, and then when you walk into the stadium, you walk through the parking lot, everybody's there waiting for you to encourage you on. So it's a pretty special experience, being a part of that. And then just day to day, like everybody's behind you, you know, it's always, oh, if you didn't do well the weekend, don't worry, we'll get them this weekend. Or, you know, oh, Cudmore, you're a bit shit, but you know, you'll do okay next weekend. That's what I normally heard, but it's amazing how much, that whole region is behind that team. So, you know, the 11 years I was there, it was a huge part of my life. Our kids are born there. My wife and I, we were married in a little lake near our home there. And it was a special experience. And, you be a part of, building the club to kind of get them to that European status of where they are now. Like they're one of the best clubs in Europe. To be a part of that, I'm hugely proud of that time for sure.
Yeah, it's interesting before, Jamie, when you said you didn't realize sort of professional rugby could be a career until you kind of came over to Europe. So when you are, preparing for a match, those fans are gathering outside the hotel, do you kind of maybe pinch yourself a little bit that not only are you representing Clermont, but you're also very much an integral part of Canada's international team and going to as many World Cups as you did? You must be thinking, wow, I didn't think this might have been possible a few years ago.
Yeah, well, I've definitely reflected on that since I've finished playing. I think when you're in it, you don't really think about it too much, I think, because you've got so much going on and you're quite focused on the task at hand. But definitely a reflection over the last few years of when you're coaching, you get time to kind of think about all those things. And you're exactly right. And we're very fortunate to be involved with Canada at the highest level in the World Cups, and then Clermont, and being just getting paid to do what I love to do is obviously very, very fortunate.
Now, I've got to mention as well, Jamie, you've probably been asked it a number of times, but at the World Cup in 2015 against France, there's that famous video of you joining the French huddle. Now, I was at that game covering it for work in Milton Keynes, and everyone still talks about that clip and everyone does an interview with you. So what was going through your mind? I know, was it one of your neighbours was part of the French team that day? That's right.
Well, my teammate, my friend Damien Chouli, he was playing back row for France that day, and he called the lineouts at Clermont, and he also called the lineouts for the French team. And Nathan Hines and I think I probably took it from Nathan. We used to come lazily through the team huddle in club rugby all the time, just to kind of just tee boys up a bit and just give them a bit of a tickle, just have a laugh. And I did the same thing. I just went in and said, "Oh, Damien, qu'est-ce qu'on fait? Like, what are we doing? What are we doing?" And he didn't even look up. He just goes, and he said the call. I'm like, "Oh, okay, middle back. Okay, perfect." And he looks up and he goes, "Oh no, Diguez, like, get out of here." And then Rabah grabbed me and pulled me out of the way, and I was just having a good laugh. And but unfortunately, we weren't defending in the air in the 5 meters, so I just kind of told the boys, "Listen, middle back," and they won line. We tried to defend. Unfortunately, they're a pretty good team, so they managed to get over the line. But it was a bit of a laugh. We do that in club, and like we were at club all the time. You like act like you're doing up your shoes, and then you just walk through the huddle as they're kind of set up for their lineout, and just get them off their game. You know, it's. bit of a laugh.
Yeah, definitely, Jamie. And just in terms of the French national team, now you said that they were a strong team in 2015, but they seem to be in a really good place at the moment. And I guess you may still obviously keep an eye on their development because you spent 15 years in France overall, if that's right. So they seem to be in a really good place. And at the moment, we've done a couple of interviews, as I said there, with Benjamin Kayser, who's really excited about what France can bring over the next 2 years leading up to the World Cup. And in the running order, we did say to you, Six Nations, France are looking strong now, and you just put, I think they will win it. Is it as simple as that?
Well, it's definitely not as simple as that, but I do think they will win. You know, if you look at the last few under 20 world championships, they've either won or been there, thereabouts. I think they won both. And with the GIF rule in France over the last 10 years of having to promote more French qualified players, it's now starting to work. You know, it's clearly starting to work. They've got these amazingly talented players. They're playing regularly in the top 14, and they're getting drawn up into the French team, and they're playing. They're chopping and changing a little bit because I understand, you know, they're building out a wider squad for 2023. There's definitely, you can see the 3 year, 4 year plan is in place. But the fact is that they've got, you know, some really exciting, Dupont, Jalibert, you know, all these 9-10 combinations that they have. They got Baptiste Serrin. There's some big, strong forwards up front, so they can create a good platform. They got a pretty decent back row, guys that are good in the air, tough kids. They got some real lightning out back, Vakatawa, you can put him on the wing, you can put him in the center. Out back, you've got Ramos, Thomas, who else? There's so many new young kids coming through, and it's really exciting that these kids are now getting a chance to play regularly in top 14 and then with the French team. And they've got some real X factor. You know, they've got guys that can break the line, guys that can keep the ball alive, and they got speed pretty much everywhere, you know, bar maybe the front five, depending on how they put them together. But it's a pretty, pretty exciting mix. And yeah, no, I do think they are going to win the Six Nations.
Yeah, we talked about French rugby a lot, Jamie, but I can't talk about France without talking about your love for wine you developed over in France. And doing a little bit of research, and you have corrected me, you did own a wine bar where you were over there. You owned a nightclub and a sports bar as well, and you had your own wine label. Is that a love that's continued over when you've been back in Canada?
Yeah, I know. I've always been really, really interested in, you know, how it's made and, you know, the makeup of it and the fact that it's, you know, it's a natural product, which is great to enjoy, you know, like with food. And it's a great add on to any meal, you know, a good glass of wine, you know, a good meal with friends, like it's not much better, you know what I mean? So, you know, the fact that we were involved in it with the Sinbin and then the Blood Brothers after was a great experience for us. But towards the end of my career, you know, coaching, you know, the fact that we were working with a cave down in Bergerac, just off the property line from Bordeaux, it was just too much. You know, it was too much with rugby and family, and my wife has other business interests. It was just too much. We ended up selling everything when we moved back to Canada, but still have some great connections in wine regions around France, up in Bourgogne, down in Châteauneuf, all up and down the Rhone Valley. Because, you know, in the south, in the Rhone Valley, for me, that's where the best wine is. It was a learning experience, and then, you know, continued on with a passion that we both have, and we'll do something in Canada in the future.
I love the name Sinbin, Jamie. I think it's fantastic.
Well, it was obviously a little tongue-in-cheek because, we just wanted to have a bit of fun with it, yeah. You know, like, it's not pretentious. We're not trying to take myself seriously. Like, it was fun, you know. It was a white wine with the yellow card and the red wine with the red card and me punching out a bear on the label. Like, it was a bit of fun. And people loved that. And, you know, they enjoyed the product, and, you know, people supported us, and that was really great. So, it was a good experience all around.
Jamie, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting to you on the Loose Heads podcast today. Thank you for taking the time to chat to us. And we really appreciate, obviously, you talking about your rugby career, but also touching on concussion, because we know it's such an important topic still in rugby. And so thank you for being open and discussing the situation as well. So, Jamie, thank you very much for your time today on the Loose Heads podcast.
No problem, boys. Thank you. And, you know, stay safe. Hope everybody managed to get through this okay. And, happy to speak in the future. Take it easy, boys.
You're listening to the Loose Heads podcast. Join the movement.
Let's get people talking about mental health.
And together we will tackle the stigma. This is the Loose Heads podcast.